From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from the Excelsior.
West Portal.
Potrero Hill.
I'm from the Bayview.
Coming up on the second anniversary of Michael Brown's death at the hands of police, we're airing your reflections on the past 2 years of Black Lives Matter.
He's too young for me to say, hey, one day you're not going to be liked because people are going to think that you're a threat or dangerous.
Then, how relaxed conservation measures don't mean the drought is over.
Just because you can pass a stress test doesn't mean you don't need to be communicating with your customers that we need to keep conserving, because we do need to keep conserving.
And we experience the magic of finding water underground.
Is there water 100 feet? Is there water 200 feet? Is there water 300 feet?
So, is there? Wait and find out today on Cross Currents. On the two-year anniversary of the death of Michael Brown, we're taking stock of how Bay Area residents perceive their relations with police. We sent reporters around the region to hear what you had to say.
So, my name is Juan Melgar. I live in San Bruno, California. You know, I'm seeing a lot of distrust. I'm seeing a lot of anger towards the police force right now. Personally, I haven't dealt with any situations that have made me deal with situations with police, but in the past I know that I have. And I know they're doing their job, they have families. I wish that they would respect people with dignity and honor that we as citizens deserve.
Brandon Turnage, I live in the Mission.
What is your perception of the San Francisco Police Department?
As of lately, I feel pretty positive, but I do know there's been a lot of wrongdoings on their behalf. I've seen a lot of people protesting out in front of the police stations and things like that recently. But as far as like my commute and things like that, they do make that seem a little bit easier, so that's been pretty positive.
My name is Stephen Galloway.
And what neighborhood do you live in?
The Tenderloin.
So what do you think of the San Francisco Police Department?
I think like every police department around the country right now, there's a lot of really, really good people who are just trying to do their jobs and do right by people. But I do think that there's an underbelly of corruption that needs to be dealt with. It's easy for us as a society to only look at the bad. I mean, it's human nature to only look at the negative. And I know there's a lot of it. But for every bad story that you hear about, there's 10 good ones that you don't. And having an uncle who was a captain in the Baltimore Police Force, I know there are a lot of people out there that are great at what they do, and we rely on them. So there are heroes as well as, you know, problems as well. So let's not lose sight of that.
Deborah Williams.
And are you from Oakland?
Yes, I am from Oakland.
And do you think that the problems that the Oakland Police Department faces and the things that have been going on here reflective of what's going on across the country?
I think it's fleck everywhere. It's not just Oakland, it's everywhere. And I think the government should be in a part of this, because then the president should step forward and have somebody into each of these cities and change what's going on. We're talking about people's lives has been taken. Mm-hmm. You can't get that back. Oakland's not a bad city. San Francisco's not a bad city. It's the people. So Oakland's a beautiful place. We have to make it beautiful, even more beautiful, by stepping up, doing what's right, and stay together as a community and organizations get together and fight against these issues until something happened the right way.
Those voices were recorded by KALW's Dora Finkelstein, Nicole Grigg, and Jürgen Klemm. And to those of you listening right now, what have you got to say? Share your thoughts at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We'll be airing your perspectives all week long. As part of our exploration of police and community relations, we've partnered with the East Bay Express. In the wake of this summer's video recordings of police shootings of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, they published a series of commentaries, and we recorded some of them for you. Today, we'll hear from two mothers who wrote about their struggles talking with their young sons about race and racism. First, we'll hear from Cheryl Lane, who lives with her 4-year-old son in Richmond.
The rural streets image, just the cute
boy, right? And I've always said that. I remember when he was really young, I used to see him. He was like a magnet. It didn't matter who and what you were, what nationality, age, he just drew people to him. We could be in a restaurant, we could be shopping for shoes, and people would always come up to him. And then I remember thinking that one day they won't do that because they'll be scared of him, right? So they won't just be friendly and say, hey, how are you doing? He's too young for me to say, hey, one day you're not gonna be liked because people are gonna think you're gonna do something to them or that you're a threat or dangerous, you know? One day I'll have to have that conversation with them. All kids have innocence at some point, and then that innocence is gone because they realize what the real world is like, right? But some kids won't have to worry about being perceived a certain way because of their skin color. So I think that's the major difference, and that's why there's sadness there. Breathing in Black by Cheryl Lane. Why did they kill him? Did they kill him because he was wearing a red shirt? That's unfair. Those were the words coming from my 4-year-old Black son as we watched television and together witnessed the brutality and killing of Alton Sterling by Baton Rouge police officers. So in my 4-year-old's mind, the only connection he could make for what he was seeing was that a man was killed because he wore a red shirt and it was wrong for police officers to take his life. What I didn't tell my son is that Alton was killed, not because his shirt was red, but because his skin was Black, his gender was male, and that one day he will be looked upon the same way, a threat because he is breathing in Black. I know enough to know that my son's threat index is rising by the year. My son and I have robust conversations about everything from Curious George and Fireman Sam to Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. But I'm also beginning to incorporate race and social justice into our conversations, which he tries to understand but doesn't quite get yet. Will my son sell DVDs and CDs outside of a store and have the police called on him? Will he be driving a car with his girlfriend like Philando Castile and be pulled over by police and within minutes be shot to death in the front seat? To all these things I say, I don't know. I can't predict every experience in his future. I can only prepare him for it. I strive for him to be well-educated, to be kind, strong, confident, and enlightened, but none of these things are a shield against racism, implicit bias, and oppression. So what do I want? There are a menu of ideas out there from body cameras, better police training, and prosecution. But more than anything, I want my son and all Black women and men to be seen as human. Let's start there.
That was Cheryl Lane of Richmond reading from a commentary she wrote for the East Bay Express. Another mom, Vicky Machiavello, lives in Oakland. As a white woman, Vicky says she was raised to be colorblind, but was not challenged to think about the complexities or origins of racism. Now, she wants to do better in teaching her own sons about the issue. She wrote a personal essay titled, Please Join Me. Here's an excerpt.
I couldn't sleep after watching the videos, the murder and lack of concern for fellow human beings, death at the hands of those sworn to protect. I know it's not new. I've hardly spoken up before. I'm white. What would I say? How could I say something and not appear ignorant or stupid or trite? But this time it's different. I'm not sure exactly how, but it is. I'm willing to take a risk, willing to stand up and be uncomfortable. But is this enough? Not really, when I lay awake at night wondering how Black mothers must look at their beautiful boys and feel a fear I will never fully understand. I want to tell myself I made a difference, but I've only just begun. I'm far from the social justice warrior I wish myself to be. I can do so little as one person, but I will stand in my discomfort and I will say without exception that Black lives matter. I will say it, live it, and teach it to my own sons until it is true, without exception. Perhaps you can too. Please join me. I will go places with my kids. This can make me cry. I mean, I'll go places with my kids and I'll be in a restaurant and I will, it's usually around mass shootings, but suddenly I'll just be like, oh my God, someone could come in here and blow us all away right now. It could just be done right now and it could be that quick. You know, and in those moments, I like take stock of my kids, take stock of the doors and like realize like, how am I going to protect all of them right now? You know, and that's a very real thing I feel weekly, you know, it's scary. And life is not guaranteed for any of us, you know? It's really devastating that skin color can dictate that it's more or less guaranteed for others. And I think that is really baloney. You know, I think that's horrible. It's horrible. It's horrible.
That was Vicky Machiavello, one of the many Bay Area residents who wrote into the East Bay Express in response to police violence against Black people. Those pieces were produced by KALW's Justine Lee and Lucy King. We'll hear another perspective each day this week. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba. Remember the drought? Or wait, isn't that over? Sadly, no. A recent study of NASA's satellite data analyzed California's mountain snowpack, and it found that we'd need four more wet years to escape drought conditions. The state ended mandatory water restrictions earlier this year, but now water agencies will have to perform what's called a stress test to make sure they can handle more dry conditions. KALW's environment reporter Angela Johnston has more.
If you ask experts what the biggest drought news is right now, there's one thing they can all agree on. We're still very much in it.
So we are still in a drought.
One, the drought's not over.
We're still very much in a drought.
There's still a drought. And a lot of the impacts of the drought aren't necessarily seen in our coastal cities, in LA, in San Francisco, San Diego, but they are there.
That was Doug Ajibi, Jeff Mount, Paula Kehoe, and Max Gomberg. Gomberg, the climate and conservation manager for the State Water Resources Control Board, says that despite the drought's persistence, things have improved. This past winter's rains and successful conservation efforts by urban Californians meant it was time to ditch the top-down mandatory restrictions.
We backed off a little bit and we changed course. And what we did is we said, what we need to know now is how reliable are our urban supplies if we have additional years of drought?
So now the state is requiring water agencies to prove they have enough water to last three more dry years. It's something called a stress test. Agencies have to submit paperwork showing where their water will come from and how they know they have enough.
And we're currently going through voluminous submissions of those stress tests and looking at how resilient and how vulnerable are some of our urban water suppliers.
And if an agency can't prove they have enough water, they will need to impose conservation requirements to make up that shortfall.
So, for example, if their stress test shows that they are 11% away from meeting the demand, then their required conservation level is 11%.
Some water agencies, like in Santa Cruz County and farther down the Central Coast, are opting out of the stress test and continuing to work with a mandatory conservation requirement. But the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, or the SFPUC, is glad to have their resources freed up so they can pursue other conservation projects they've had planned for a while, including a new recycled water treatment plant. Paula Kehoe, SFPUC's Director of Water Resources, explains.
Recycled water is taking wastewater that runs through our wastewater treatment plants. The treatment plant takes our sewage, treats it to what we call secondary standards, disinfection, and then that water is discharged to the San Francisco Bay and Pacific Ocean. What recycled water does is take that secondary effluent and treats it further using additional treatment.
Kehoe says the recycled water will be used to irrigate the city's golf courses and parks. I meet up with her at Stowe Lake in Golden Gate Park.
We are planning to irrigate all of Golden Gate Park with recycled water.
In 2 years, the plants and lawns around this man-made lake will be given recycled water instead of groundwater. Even the lake itself will be topped off with recycled water. The groundwater that used to be supplied for this purpose will then be mixed with San Francisco drinking water.
Drinking groundwater is a common practice in California. Our neighbors to the south, city of Daly City and San Bruno, currently part of their drinking water supply is coming from groundwater.
Like other agencies, the SFPUC has removed their mandatory conservation requirements, but they're still telling people to voluntarily reduce their water consumption by 10%. But getting people to voluntarily change their habits may be hard, according to National Resources Defense Council lawyer Doug Ajibi.
When you look back a couple of years, the governor ordered voluntary conservation, and it was pretty much an abject failure. We really didn't see the kinds of water savings that the state needed. And when the state put in place that mandatory conservation, people really rose to the occasion. And we found that we can sustain our economy and quality of life with some, you know, relatively small changes.
Ajibi thinks the state may be sending mixed signals to consumers with the new stress test approach. And he may have a point. The Water Resources Control Board just reported that Californians conserved less water this June than they did in previous years, 21% less than in 2013.
But there are concerns that people will go back to those more wasteful habits without that sort of that requirement, that mandate to conserve.
The Water Board says an initial dip is to be expected, and it's too soon to tell if it'll be a continuing trend. Jeff Mount, a senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute's Water Policy Center, is confident water users have learned a lesson from last year's restrictions.
Droughts lead to long-lasting changes.
Mount thinks conservation becomes embedded into our culture.
And it probably won't be at the level of conservation that we've had these last 2 years. But for the long term, it's going to be important. I mean, people forget that we added, since 1990, we've added something on the order of 12 million people in California, and we're using less water than we did in 1990. And the only way we do that is by being much more efficient.
There are also concerns that conservation requirements stifle long-term innovation. Some water agencies argued that the restrictions didn't give them any credit for investing millions of dollars in water recycling and desalination plants.
Let's take San Diego. That's a good example. They put $1 billion into a desalination plant, right? And because of the mandate, the conservation mandate, they weren't even able to use it, to use their plant, because they had abundant supplies. And they can't just start wasting water.
Mount thinks now that the state has pulled back its mandatory conservation requirements, water agencies will actually get to use the technology they developed when the drought first began. And ones that didn't prepare, without restrictions, Mount thinks they'll now have resources they need to invest in water conservation programs and technology, like San Francisco's Recycled Water Project.
The folks who spent the money did the best during this drought. Why should they be the ones who have to bear this mandatory burden?
Still, even though the restrictions have been removed for now, they could return if California has an extremely dry winter. The Water Resources Control Board will reevaluate in January. For Cross Currents, I'm Angela Johnston.
You can reach Angela with your environmental stories by emailing environment@kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba. 5 years of drought have forced Californians to turn from the sky to the ground to find our most precious resource. Water is down there, but you have to know exactly where it is. And even in 2016, there can be some magic in that search. Maybe. KALW's Leela Day went to Napa Valley to see how a local water witch finds water underground.
Is there 40 gallons a minute? Yes.
Mark Mondavi is a winemaker.
Is there 50 gallons a minute?
You might recognize his name from the wine aisle at the grocery store.
Is there 60?
Right now, he's walking out near his vines in Napa Valley.
Is there 70 gallons a minute?
But his focus is not on wine. He's looking for water. He's holding two thin L-shaped iron rods. They're called divining rods. And he's asking them, where's the water?
Then we have to find out, how deep do we drill? Is there water 100 feet? Is there water 200 feet? Is there water 300 feet?
Mark Mondavi searches for water underground by letting something unexplained guide him.
I think it's just something you have in your body. Some people can run a Ouija board, some people can't.
Mondavi says a lot of farmers in the valley rely on water witches.
A good 50% or more of the customers will probably use a water witch if they have the space for multiple drilling sites.
That's Gonzalo Salinas. He's one of the owners of McLean & Williams, a drilling company in Napa.
There's been cases where we go and drill a well in a property and the site has been picked by a geologist or somebody with different type of instrumentation to locate the well site, and it turned out to be a dry hole, a dry well. Then the witcher will come over and pick another site, and it turned out to be a well.
Selena says no method of finding water is guaranteed, but
on the scale 1 to 10, water witching is probably a 7.
And it's cheaper.
A witcher can range anywhere between $500 to probably $1,000 to come over and witch a site for you to drill. Where geologists, you can spend sometimes as much as the well, thousands of dollars to do a study.
Selena says he can also detect these energies underground.
20 years ago, if somebody was to call me and ask me where they can locate a witcher, I normally made the joke to look in the Yellow Pages and look under a spooky. I didn't believe on it, but over the years, I started doing it myself, and then I became more of a believer.
It all sounds so simple. If you feel the energy, let the sticks point you into the direction, and poof, there may be water. But a hydrogeologist would recommend something a little more concrete.
Look at some of the written records by previous geotechnical engineering contractors on that area.
That's Norman Miller, a professor at UC Berkeley's Department of Geography.
Do some research with the Department of Water Resources and try to find archives of what is already known before doing anything.
Some hydrogeologists even use ground-penetrating radar to detect water underground. Miller tells me that blindly drilling for water is definitely not the best way to go. So I ask him what he thinks about the powers of dowsing.
Well, I'm an optimist, and I think that there may be things that I'm not that aware of that go beyond my perspectives and worldviews, so I'm going to stay open-minded.
Which is exactly what the dowsers recommend to find water the old-fashioned way. The magic of the divining rods and an open mind. Back on Mark Mondavi's vineyard, he pulls out a bottle of the divining rod, a new wine label of his with two dowsing rods crisscrossed on the front.
Ex aqua venum. From water comes wine.
You just have to know how to find the water. For Cross Currents, I'm Leela Day.
That's it for today's show. We had help from Olivia Henry, Chris Hoff, Lisa Morehouse, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Andrew Stelzer. Line producer was Liza Veal. Our managing editor is Jen Cheehan. Our managing producer is Julie Kane. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. The music you're hearing now is by the San Francisco Guzheng Music Society. The guzheng is a traditional plucked string instrument that dates back well over 2,000 years. The San Francisco Guzheng Society takes part in the 7th annual Chinatown Music Festival on Saturday in Portsmouth Square. The event begins at 11 a.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.